Today may not be the best example of an impossibly hot day in the Kansas City metro area, but we know it's coming. Come on. Also, it's not our imagination that the temperatures seem way warmer when we're in the downtown area than when we go out to rural areas. It's a phenomenon called urban heat islands, and that's what we'll be talking about this morning. Joining me for this discussion are Tom Jacobs, Environmental Program Director with Mid-America Regional Council. Hey, Tom.
Hi, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. And Kyle Reed, a master's degree student who researches urban heat islands. How you doing, Kyle?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, great. Okay, so Tom, I'm going to start with you. What is an urban heat island?
So you can think about the way we build cities, right? And they typically are hotter than outlying rural areas because we have all this thermal mass. We have buildings and parking lots and streets that absorb heat and retain heat. And that all adds up to making a downtown area hotter than a rural area.
I have a stupid question, but is the same the true for cold?
Well, I don't really know. I've seen reports about urban cool islands, but it's a topic that's less studied perhaps than heat islands. Heat islands seem more germane to a lot of conversations because of the incredible public health threats that they present and the challenges they pose for energy conservation and a wide variety of other factors.
That makes sense. So why does heat build up, Tom?
Heat builds up because we have all these heat-absorbing surfaces in cities, right? And so if you were in a rural area and there was a more vegetated space, then trees and grasses and streams will literally cool the environment. In an urban space with buildings and impervious areas that are just absorbing heat during these hot days, they'll just hold on to it and suck it up and elevate the temperatures by 5 or 10 degrees in a hot July or August day.
Wow, so you're saying 5 to 10 degrees higher it can go?
Absolutely.
Wow. So does every city have one?
Yeah, it's a widespread phenomenon that's been increasingly recognized, and there's people all over the country who are working on this and trying to think about how is it that we can reduce all of these urban heat islands in efforts to make to increase quality of life, to reduce greenhouse gases, to green cities in service of public health and improved air quality and energy conservation.
Tom, Mark worked on, and by Mark, Mid-America Regional Council, worked on a study about Kansas City's heat island a few years ago. What did that study find?
We worked with the Lawrence Berkeley National Labs on an assessment of heat islands in our metro area. I want to back up just for a minute. A number of partners in our metro area worked together, and we received a designation from the Obama administration as a climate action champion that culminated in our publication of a report called A Regional Climate Resilience Strategy. And as part of that effort, we wanted to look at heat islands in more depth because it's one of those issues that if you can tackle it attaches to all kinds of other issues and helps you advance sustainability and resilience on many fronts at the same time. And so we worked with Lawrence Berkeley, and they did a model of weather patterns in our metro area and looked at the relationship between heat and energy consumption and then tried to assess the impacts of different countermeasures or measures that would reduce heat island impacts, things like white roofs or green roofs or street trees or stormwater management. And what their findings were is that, in fact, we do have a very substantial heat island. And
Kansas City has one of the worst, if I recall something that I read. Isn't that true?
That's right. There was a report issued by the National Weather Service, and they had developed something called a Climate Disruption Index that ranked Kansas City 5th in the country in terms of heat island impacts.
Ooh, this.
Yeah.
I mean, there are days when I feel that, but I just thought that was me. I didn't know there was scientific evidence for that.
Yeah.
So are we talking, since we're talking Kansas City, I always think of Kansas City, Missouri as having almost two downtowns, like the actual literal downtown and then the plaza, which functions as a sort of a center point of a lot of people and visitors. Is it measuring both of those areas or just downtowns?
Well, our study looked at the whole nine-county metro area. So we were looking at, you know, a 4,400-square-mile area in the greater Kansas City area. So the methodology that Lawrence Berkeley used really wasn't able to assess impacts at that granular of a level. But it's fair to say that anywhere where there's higher concentrations of buildings in impervious areas, there will be elevated heat islands. And so in those kinds of places are probably where we'd find the biggest benefit from employing these different kinds of remediation strategies.
So that gets to Kyle, your area of expertise. You've been doing research on mitigation strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is mitigation strategy?
Yeah, so good question. Mitigation is basically where you try to reduce the urban heat island effect. So like Tom had said, the temperatures within the city are relatively high compared to the rural areas. And what these mitigation strategies try to do is try to reduce the urban temperatures. And what we looked at specifically, my advisor, Dr. Sun, and I, is we looked at how can cool roofs affect the urban heat island. And by cool roofs, we mean typical roofs absorb a lot of the solar radiation that come in upon it. And with cool roofs, it's reflecting quite a bit more solar radiation. So you're not getting that as much absorption of heat as you typically would with a low reflectivity standard roof.
Okay. So, you know, of course, when I saw that about cool roofs, I was just thinking, so you're talking about rooftop happy hours with really icy drinks?
No.
But I don't think that's what you meant by mitigation, right?
Right. No.
Darn it.
No, it's not.
Darn it. I thought I had a grasp of that.
Unfortunately, no.
But is that something that you feel that could take in Kansas City?
I feel like it could, yes. I think Tom would be able to answer more on, you know, the city being able to assist in people doing that sort of thing. But the cost, when you compare replacing a roof with standard materials compared to those with higher amounts of reflectivity, it's not that much of a difference. So I think, you know, over long term, it is something that would be able to catch on.
So Tom, is there a bigger reason, or is there a reason why this seems to be more of an issue today than, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Of course it is. I think everybody is very clear at this point in time about the impacts that we've already experienced relative to climate change and those that are coming. We conducted a model looking at what our future might look like in Kansas City under different climate change scenarios. And if we continue as a world to emit greenhouse gases at the rate that we currently are, Kansas City will go from having an average of one day over 105 degrees per year to about 20. And so urban heat islands, of course, exacerbate that trend. And as we're concerned about public health threats related to, for example, heat strokes, heat waves, as we're interested in ground level ozone, which becomes even more elevated on the super hot days, as we're interested in issues of public safety or worker productivity, as we're interested in greenhouse gas emissions reduction, that you know, when it gets hotter, we crank up the air conditioner a little bit higher. For all these different reasons, we want to figure out every single way that we can to make our community better, to create more jobs, to make our quality of life higher, while at the same time reducing emissions and increasing public health.
You know, and one of the things that I couldn't help but think about, and just studying up on this, it's a minute bit compared to what you all know about it, is that Kansas City downtown area is just getting so congested with lofts and an mm-hmm. increase in business. I mean, things that are positive in some ways, it's not, but it's a lot more people in a small chunk of land. Have you thought about that in terms of either one of you in terms of your studies?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is downtown, there's quite a number of green roofs. So when we talk about cool roofs, white roofs, there's also green roofs. And so there's a number of buildings that have green roofs on it, which are an incredible strategy for reducing heat islands. But there's all kinds of things underway in the city planning world that point towards heat island reduction strategies. As we try to make streets more walkable and transit friendly, then sometimes we'll be considering how we can shrink the width of roads. We can think about setback requirements. We can think about where we put parking, how much parking we have, we can think about the vegetation we have downtown or anywhere, thinking about street trees or open spaces. And all of those things, as you package them up together, create a suite of strategies that reduce heat island effects, but at the same time achieve all these other goals of making downtown the incredible, you know, vibrant place that it is.
Ah, I see what you're saying. So it's not as if it's just a bunch of people moving downtown willy-nilly. You're saying that in some cases you're seeing some real thoughtful strategies to combat the increase because, you know, more people, for example, is more cars.
Right.
Right. So do things like the people, the birds, the limes, do they help in terms of those scooters?
So from a heat island perspective, I'm not sure that those would make a direct impact. But from a transportation alternatives perspective, if we're pulling cars off the streets and people are walking or riding the bus or using scooters or something like that, riding their bikes around, then that's going to reduce congestion. It's going to reduce emissions. And so it's a generally positive thing. The scooters bring with it their own complications, of course. But from a transportation perspective, there's a lot of opportunities to get people out of driving their cars by themselves and thinking about getting around in different kinds of ways that are more active, that are good for just the vibrancy of a city, right?
I drive a little Fiat, so I feel like I'm doing, you know, my part in reducing the urban heat imprint. Mm-hmm. Kyle, you've done some work studying urban heat and poverty. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've kind of, our main focus has been looking at the urban heat island so far. So we use climate models to help look at how the urban heat island is in Kansas City and what we can do to mitigate that. So what we found is that the more highly densely populated areas are areas that are more built up, that have more pavement, higher density of buildings. So we were seeing a greater reduction in the urban temperatures there as compared to more the suburban areas. So I feel by implementing these types of measures, we can help reduce the urban heat island. Some of these individuals that may be able or not be able to afford a car, that may have to walk to work, walk to the bus stop, they'll have improved quality of life by having reduced temperatures. It'll be easier for them.
So, I mean, just speaking from my own background, you know, times in my life and people that I know, I know that the less money you have, the poorer you are, the closer you have to usually live to other human beings. Mm-hmm. That it's, you know, usually a bunch of apartments and buildings that people have to live, you know, practically on top of one another. Is right. That part of increasing sort of this urban heat island?
I would say so. Whenever you get more people in a densely packed area, a lot of the biggest impact would definitely be the urban surfaces, so the pavement and buildings, things like that. But also you have a higher density of vehicles that are putting off heat, greenhouse gases, buildings. When you're putting people more densely together, you're going to have to build upwards. So you're not going to get that airflow through the city, so that heat just kind of sits there and stagnates.
So, you know, I got to go to the basic bottom line. For the average person who goes from one air-conditioned pod in their life to another, right? You know, you're at home with air conditioning, you get in your car, turn on the air conditioning, you get to work, and it's air-conditioned. Mm-hmm. I've had some jobs where that was its best benefit, air conditioning in the summertime, but not KCR. So why would that matter to the average person who has air conditioning?
Well, let me take this from the other perspective, from sort of the social equity perspective. What happens if you're in an environment where your cooling bills are just really high and you can't afford to pay them? So if we can take measures that reduce urban heat islands, right, then that's going to reduce how much you reduce your cooling load. But at the same time, you can couple that with with energy efficiency measures in these more populated areas in ways that are more affordable for communities in need. And so you can increase comfort, but at the same time address these public health risks that come every time there's another crazy heat wave. But if we're just in average, you know, home and we got the air conditioner cranked up, if it's a little bit cooler outside because we've taken measures to reduce heat islands, we're going to use less energy because we aren't going to have to cool as much.
And that makes a lot of sense to me. I also wonder, you know, I'm no expert, but how does this tie to climate change?
So we can expect Kansas City to be a lot hotter in the future. We don't know exactly how much hotter. And if we have an urban environment where there's heat islands, right, it's just going to be that much worse. And so the question we've been asking about how do we make Kansas City a more resilient place, you know, the way I like to think of it is, what is it that we can do today that'll make tomorrow a little bit better because we were thinking about this stuff mm-hmm. ahead of time. And so planting trees is just a really simple measure that cools the city but provides all these other benefits. It makes our streets more walkable. It improves air quality. It improves water quality. It reduces the risk of flooding and so on and so on. And so when we think about climate change, urban heat island mitigation is just part of that conversation. And in a discussion that's as complex as the one about climate, everything kind of ties together in complicated ways. And so, you know, for example, if we're reducing heat-absorbing areas, we're shrinking the impervious areas in our communities, and we are at the same time improving transit. We're making our communities more walkable. We are perhaps able to create more green spaces. We're improving biodiversity in the process. We're improving air quality and water quality. So it's all a package. And on the heat island side, then maybe we'll talk more about public health and energy. But it's connected to all these other issues that we're concerned about as a community.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned public health because that's what I think of when I think about it getting too hot or being too hot in the area that you live in. Because I know my allergies, for example, I have allergies and slight asthma that only gets worse the hotter it is. And so that's a good transition to asking about cooling centers. So we have Roosevelt Lyons on the phone, and he's the Deputy Director of Parks and Recreation for Kansas City, Missouri. You there, Roosevelt?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. So when it gets to be a certain temperature, the Parks Department opens up cooling centers. Can you tell us what those are and how those work?
Sure. So the Kansas City, Missouri Parks and Recreation Department operates 10 community centers across the city, as far north as I-29 and Waccomas and all the way out to Hillcrest Road. And at those centers, during the summertime when it's hot out, you can walk into any 10 of those centers and hang out there completely free and cool down and enjoy just our staff helping and whatever you need there. So it's completely free. You just have to go to kcparks.org to check out the locations and get all the information about locations and stop on in. You don't need to call ahead. You don't need to register. Just walk in.
Do you feel that a lot of people in the community are aware of and use those cooling centers?
You know, we don't see it as much. Every time we hear about somebody having some health-related issue due to heat, we always think we can do more. So we do get some people that come through every now and then, but, you know, we definitely try to take every avenue to tell people about that, and we send out some pressers and post it on our social media and all that kind of stuff, so...
Roosevelt, I just have a little, just a few more seconds, but in my remaining time, what else can people do to stay cool on these super hot days?
Sure. So KC Parks also operates over 20 swimming pools across the city. Some you can go to for as low as $1. If that's not cool enough for you, you can come to, we have 3 indoor pools. So those are as low as $2 a day per person. And if that's not cool enough for you, we actually operate an ice skate rink at Lion Creek Ice Arena up north, and you can go there and ice skate and stay cool there as well. If you don't know how to swim, we'll actually teach you for free. So we offer free swim lessons for anybody for the first 2 lessons. So we'll get you proficient in swimming.
Oh, that sounds great. That in and of itself is enough reason to go get cool out by the pool, is learn how to swim. Yep. So thank you so much, Roosevelt. We've also been talking with Tom Jacobs from the Mid-America Regional Council. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Michelle.
And Kyle Reed, a student researcher at UMKC. I really appreciate your contributions. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
We've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll revisit our conversation with local rapper and philanthropist A.Y. More of KCUR Central Standard in just a minute. Please don't go away. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and I'm filling in for Gina Kaufman. Last fall, Gina interviewed local performer A.Y. before his show at Open Spaces. He's got another show coming up this Friday, so let's listen back to that conversation.
A.Y. Young is a rapper from Kansas City. He does outdoor shows that run totally on solar power. His goal is to provide solar power batteries for disaster relief. He's got catchy songs like this. But he didn't learn to sound like this by rapping along with the pros. He never heard rap music as a kid, so he totally made it up. Let's listen. Thought I'd never make it like the rappers on the TV screen. It was a dream, now I'm 19 and my flow boy is about to meet the world. Topanga, and all my doubters can stack up the odds. Jenga, but I'm greatness personified. I've been through the heinous, rigorous training. My city needs a savior, sick of all the gangs and the swag. Hey, I'm what you asked for. To my city, Kansas City, I've arrived. FYI, and most of y'all rappers couldn't measure to my eye. You only got waist high, and that's a waste of a waste. You're taking up space, step aside. I'm confident, my confidence sitting all the time high. So as I wave high, man, throw your hands in the sky and wave goodbye. So I say hey, wave to the world.
A.Y., good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
We just heard what I think it's fair to call your big hit, Say Hey, and your Kansas City pride is really on full display in those lyrics. Tell me about your roots here.
I was born and raised here. I was homeschooled, so my mom taught me everything. Shout out to my mom. And so Kansas City is my hometown. It's the place that I, created all these ideas from. So when I created Say Hey, I just got off the X Factor TV show, and I just knew I wanted to say hey to the world.
You were on the X Factor TV show?
Heck yes.
Tell me more about that.
It was good. I got four yeses from the celebrity judges. So that's Ellie Reed, Simon Cowell. You know, we did the Sprint Center TV audition, you know, all the lights, the whole day recording. It was great. So I really learned a lot about the music business. And that helped me create Say Hey. And that really was the segue into also starting the Battery Tour, just getting into the entertainment business, learning how it works. And being told no a lot.
Well, so we are going to get to that. But the other thing on full display in this song that we just heard is your understanding of what makes something catchy. How did you learn that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Honestly, it just was natural. I'll be very honest. I wrote Say Hey in like an hour. You know, I was, because I used to be a nerd a little bit. People would pick on me because I was homeschooled. And I was just like, you know, I'm going to say hey to the world. But I also wanted to empower people to be themselves, right? To be you, to say hey to who you are, right? To be outlet. I was forming that idea of an outlet, which is, we'll talk about that later with the Battery Tour. So it just came to me naturally. I'm all about when you're listening to a song or when I'm listening to a song, I want to be able to sing it with the artist. So,
I want to get more into this homeschool thing because I understand that, you know, you weren't able to learn rap by listening to great rappers. You had to learn it in another way because you weren't exposed to rap as a kid.
I know. That's the crazy part.
So talk about that.
I know. Well, I mean, the thing is, like I said, I was homeschooled. And my mom and dad are very, like, conservative Christian, you know. So I wasn't allowed to, like, watch much TV, one soda pop a week. And like when it came to like rap music and stuff, we weren't really allowed to listen to that. And back then there weren't guys like Lecrae, people like a lot of people like that were doing like the Christian rap. At least I didn't know of it. So I didn't even know what rap was. So I used to write poetry. I would write about what I saw, which is really cool to see what like Mr. Hoffman's doing in Kansas City and about the divide. And I just saw the NBC report or whatever that was, because I used to write about that divide and how you could be on Truce and see this, but you could drive and see the Platte. So I would write about what I saw. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up right off 39th Street, 39th and Highland. So I'm right by Truce and Paseo. And, you know, so I'm experiencing these different sectors of Kansas City and the difference between the cultures and all of these different things.
How young did you start writing poetry?
I started writing probably when I was like And I was probably, I feel like this is old, like 15.
What? Do you remember, I mean, do you remember some of the images in those early poems?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the very first poem that I wrote, which ended up being my first song that I didn't release. So technically, I'd say, hey, but it was like, I was like, ain't it funny how you can be in the hood 1 minute, drive a couple of blocks, it's like a chameleon hit it. Because like, you could be literally like on Truth, a couple of blocks, and there's the plaza, or these really nice houses. So I remember seeing that and writing that line.
Do you remember how seeing that made you feel? As a Kansas Cityan and a young Kansas City?
Honestly, I was confused because I never really saw color or difference in people. You know, like, that makes sense. Like, my mom never, she taught me to love everyone and everyone's the same and everything's equal, right? So I...
And you grew up maybe sheltered from
And
some
I grew up sheltered from everything. Like, I didn't even really know how to talk to girls. So you hear me talk, like, I have songs about, like, how, you know, like the song I Might Steal Your Girl is funny. Because
we're going to hear that one soon.
Yes! In high school, dude, I was joked about a lot. And this guy on the basketball team, because I was really good at basketball, though. And he had this really hot girlfriend. I'm like, oh, I'm going to steal your girl, bro. Like, I thought that in my mind. Never stole his girl. Girl never even gave me a look. But it was that moment of me, that's what made me write the song. Like, oh, I'm sick of you joking about me, bro. I'm going to steal your girl.
So you went to an actual high school for high school.
Yeah, so I ended up not till junior year. So I ended up going to Lincoln College Prep junior year. So my whole life, you know, homeschool, junior year, go to Lincoln College Prep, and boom, you know, social norms, just talking to, seeing females. I mean, you
learning
know,
that
everything
at this stage in a person's life and in sort of the social scene that is high school seems like that would be. It's high school is an extreme time in people's social lives to just land there with no preparation for how to, like, be part of, like, a class of people in school.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you could say I had brothers and sisters. So my mom homeschooled all four of us, so it was four of us kids. So I did have interaction with people. And then there were some times that I did, like, church functions. But at the end of the day, there's nothing like high school. And yes, so I got hit with everything really fast.
Do you remember some of your early observations and, like, realizations?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I turned it all to songs. Like, and even, like, for my new album, so I'm privileged. I'm really honored. I'm working with a 5-time Grammy-winning producer. His name's Brian Kennedy, because I've been, we've been working on a lot of new music. And in this new album called Hello Again, which will come out hopefully next year, I talk a little bit more about, like, some of those experiences and not having the cool J's, not having a cell phone when everyone had one, you know, all these things. And what, so I remember everything vividly. And yeah.
Can you give us just one little tidbit that it's like, this is what high school looks like to someone who just dropped in here?
Like a song? Like a lyric?
Well, no, a memory.
A memory.
Yeah.
Like, of what high school looks like?
Yeah, from your point of view at that stage, having been homeschooled and then landing in junior year.
It felt
year.
Like a foreign country. It felt like probably what some of those foreign exchange students feel like when they walk into a place and everyone's speaking a different language. Everyone's speaking English in Lincoln Prep, and like they're speaking English, but they're speaking through social things that I don't understand because I'm used to speaking English. So even the way I spoke was so different to people that I was like foreign or I wasn't cool a lot of times or whatever, because yeah, so there's so much with the English language and even location and things like that. So I learned a lot about, which has honestly helped me as I started forming the Battery Tour and I'm in different cities and states to really acclimate myself and be able to connect to everyone, different types of people. I think I'm glad that happened because now I know how to connect and get plugged in.
What made you want to rap in the first place when you didn't know what rap was?
Yeah, so I never even, in the term rap, I don't even use the term rap. I think now I really say I'm an entertainer, and then I'll even dive into saying I'm an entrepreneur and like a micro influencer and things like that. But for me, rap, music in general, I figured out it was like a universal language. And I always wanted to change the world and make an impact on people. So for me, music was a way to influence people. And so that's just what I saw it as, not rap. Because now I sing rap. I do a lot of different things. So it's not just rap. It was more like music is a way to make a change within people, better than basketball, because that's what I went to UMKC for, was basketball. I got, you know, to play there, and that was my main thing. So, yeah, music.
You've done a lot. How old are you?
I just turned 27, yeah.
Man, okay. Yeah. So before we hear another song, I am curious about your process of building those first songs that sound to other people like rap, although that's not what you had in mind. Beginning in your musical development, when you were basically reading your poems?
Man, straight up. So, okay, but okay, so I had a little help. Which is my brother, okay? So my brother AJ, who I was also on the X Factor TV show with, right? Guitar player. The L.A. Reid, when he played the guitar, he nicknamed him the Black John Mayer. So that's how great AJ is. So when I was doing the first poem, oh, I'm so bad at saying that. See, I even say words weird still. When I was doing my first lyrics or whatever, AJ started playing the guitar to what I was saying. So we were developing records, and he was able to like play to the tempo I was saying or whatever I was feeling, play to specific words. So he's a very talented player. So I got blessed to have somebody that's like a savant on the guitar that can develop records from the bottom up. So shout out to AJ.
Okay, let's listen to another song. This one is the one you were talking about where you land in high school and you're thinking about... So this is...
Yes.
Yeah.
All the bullies out there that are joking about people, though, we might make a song about you and try to steal your girlfriend.
Okay, let's listen.
What's good, what's good, what's good? You're tuned in to Insane Radio. We got a caller on line one. Are you there?
Yes. Who is it?
Well, who is this?
Well, I'm calling because he's... Oh, my
whoa, calm down. Let's not jump to the conclusions. Bro, just chill out. Let me explain what's going on. Hate to make it so blatant, but your girl about to be taken. Hope you're open for change. Single life is what you're facing. And I can't really help it. That she's feeling me. I follow your voice since I walked up in the beauty me. Now you started thinking crazy thoughts about killing me. All because your baby told you that she want to chill with me. Shoot, you need to take a chill pill. You can't come in between love and it's feel real. Ha, okay, I'm kidding. I still am every weekend. Asian or Puerto Rican. We take whatever we can.
You are just like totally jamming out to this song right now. Has it been a while since you heard it?
Well, I mean, I perform it all the time. Yeah, but it's been a while since I heard it.
So we've heard a little bit about the backstory of this song. I Might Steal Your Girl, and I just want to acknowledge my white person delivery on that.
There's the chorus.
Steal your girl. I might steal your girl. Hey. Yeah.
So, what in your mind, what is the purpose of music? What is the purpose of entertainment?
That's crazy question.
It is.
Wow. The purpose. I don't know. I feel like music is life itself. I feel like it's a universal language. I'll say that a lot throughout the day and in general. And I think it's meant to connect, connect cross cultures. Bring people together. I think it's made to have a positive impact, but also to be relatable, to get people through hard times, things like that. I just think it's made to bring us all together. At least that's how I try to use it, like a vehicle.
AY, I need you to explain the whole battery tour thing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the battery tour, essentially, we literally do like a mini community-focused music festival. And it's powered by batteries and solar energy.
And these are usually outdoors, right?
Usually all outdoors. Involve the community, a platform for the artists. So we host artists. Some people have called it social music movement. So sometimes it's a dance party, open mic nights, so artists perform, and then a concert. I also perform my music and things like that.
So these are not usually like in show venues. These are like, you've done this outside by the J.C. Nichols Fountain, for example.
Everywhere. Yeah, actually all over America. I just got back from New York, but Burbank, California, a lot of places. So yeah, I literally set up a mini music festival. It can be up to 8 to 10 hours. And it's a show for, by, and with the people. Sometimes, you know, and involve. It's just incredible. And it's all powered by batteries and solar.
So explain the battery piece of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're the mission part of it now, what we're doing is we're using the proceeds from the battery tour to, and we're donating those to send solar power batteries to people that need them. So my partner and I, Connor Hazelrig, developed the Sunshine Box. So it's like a solar powered battery. It's like, looks like a suitcase. And we're using, we actually just did a battery tour where we raised enough to send to someone who needs access to electricity around the world.
So take me back to the beginning of this idea. What inspired you to say, I mean, meeting this person and coming up with the idea to just thinking of music shows and what you can do with them pretty differently?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was just, I was addressing a problem. So my solution to my problem, you know, I would try to open up for Wiz Khalifa. I would try to play at the Sprint Center, the Midland, right, local venues. And I was told no, or hey man, do you have a million followers? Or how many records have you sold? It's like, I haven't sold any records, but I got this song called Say Hey. So I was like, you know what, I'll make my own venue. I'll do my own shows. So in trying to figure out how to, you know, do a concert, because I didn't want to be just like a guitar player, small setup acoustic, I wanted a big loud show. So I figured out how to power a concert with a full band without using electricity, which is the help of the sun and solar energy. And so fixing that problem, I started the battery tour.
How did you get hooked up with the guy who invented the Sunshine Box?
Oh, yeah.
Had he already invented it?
She's
a woman. Sorry.
It's incredible. Connor. Yeah, Connor. So, I got hooked up with Connor like a year back or so. I was involved in the Fast Track program, Kaufman Fast Track. Shout out to Kaufman. And graduated that. And, you know, I think I had met her through my mentor, Landon Young. And she had been doing great work around the world because in doing the battery tour, I've uncovered a lot of problems and other issues. And one is there's over a billion people across the world who don't have access to electricity, right? And the fans are supporters of the battery tour. They call themselves outlets because it's powered by the people. People will donate. They're like, hey, we're your outlet. We're powering the tour, right? So that's when I kind of envisioned, well, the whole world is full of outlets, right? That just need to get plugged into the tour, you know? And so knowing that there's over a billion people who do not have electricity and need it, people in Puerto Rico right now with the disasters, over 200,000 people who do not have it. So I knew that music using the battery tour, which has been bringing people together, you know, was, I feel like, a way to help address those issues. So I just really added a little bit more to the mission of the battery tour, which is to get the world plugged in now. So now we're taking proceeds from the show, you know, from the mini concerts or the festival, and we're literally donating it to send out these batteries.
What is the craziest thing that's happened to you in the course of this tour?
I mean, I thought, like, for me as a solo artist, it was pretty dope to have, like, I talked about Wiz Khalifa or T-Pain. It was dope to have them come by my show and then say, hey, man, you're incredible. I want you to open for me. That was tight. Besides that, when you talk about four-year-olds and five-year-olds dancing, or you see people from over, like, all over. When I see, you know what? The most amazing thing is at the battery tour, like when we're on the Country Club Plaza or when we're in Burbank or whatever, or wherever we're at, and you see, like, all cultures, all types of people, all ages, all demographics together, maybe dancing to the Cupid Shuffle or jamming out to one of my original songs or whatever, or supporting a random artist that they just discovered at the battery tour. Those moments, to me, are the best ones.
You know, something that just occurred to me is that when you talk about people being together who maybe we aren't used to seeing all in one spot, all at one show, I wonder how much of that has to do with it not being a venue that has maybe some kind of baggage along with it about what kind of person goes here for shows.
It has everything to do with it. It forces us to be together and to not even look at, like, you know, because even with the traditional concert setting, one thing I'm a pro at is breaking down the fifth wall, right? So that takes, I think it's called the fifth wall, the fourth wall, where you kind
of
break down
one of those walls.
That. Yeah, that. So that's one thing I'm really good at as an entertainer. But it's really cool because, like, financial situations can create barriers, especially at, like, a concert. You spend $1,000, you'll be sitting here. You spend $200, you're over here. So it kind of just destroys that idea
of being all in it together.
Exactly.
You know, you have used the word dope a lot.
And yeah.
I bring that up only because something I've noticed in the songs I've heard of yours, the language, no matter what the subject matter, the language is very innocent.
Oh, and, of course. I mean, well, innocent, you mean clean.
Yeah.
Like your kid can listen to it.
But also, some of, like, even talking, and maybe this is because you wrote that other song when you were in high school, basically. But even talking about, like, stealing someone's girl, the way you talk about that sounds almost like a kid imagining adult content. You know what I mean?
Maybe that's how my brain
there is.
I don't freaking know.
I'm curious about your sort of philosophy around that stuff.
I'm not a drinker or a smoker. I think women are beautiful, so I don't like to objectify them in that sense. I mean, I always look, you know, I always just feel like if you're a writer, you can write about a topic with more class. If that makes sense. I'm not trying to diss other artists. I mean, some people be like, yeah, man, something to something to something. But it's like, I like to take thoughts and ideas. Like, there was one day that I wanted to be single or wanted to be love. So want to be love is what you hear in this album. Want to be single, you might hear in my next. But so I wrote about wanting to be love, but it wasn't something super sexual or degrading women. It was just the way I look at things, I guess, is maybe considered different. That's cool to know. I want my music to be accessible. And yes, I'm glad. If it's refreshing to you, that means a lot.
That was Gina Kaufman talking to AY last fall. He's got a free show this Friday at the Kansas City Museum. When we come back, we'll talk with another performer who's using traditional drumming to make a statement. Don't go away. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson, filling in today for Gina Kaufman. And before we go, we're going to talk with Bird Fleming. He's the artistic director of the Traditional Music Society. And next Wednesday, he's doing a unique commemoration of Juneteenth. Good morning, Bird.
Good morning, Michelle.
Bird is a black person of a certain age, meaning myself. I take for granted that everybody knows what Juneteenth is. How do you explain it to people who don't know?
Well, Abraham Lincoln made the proclamation to free the slaves in, I think, August of 61, and it actually was official January of 62. And all the southern states, except for the border states. Texas was a border state, and apparently they didn't get the news that slaves were free until 1865.
Yeah, that is what always sort of, you know, gets under my skin about celebrating Juneteenth. So
right.
We're celebrating the fact that black folks did not realize until like 2 years later they were free.
In that state.
Right, in that state, yeah.
Because it was a border state.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. But yeah, it is. And there's a special commemoration in terms of time coming up next week, but really this year.
Right.
What could you say what that is?
This year is the 400th anniversary commemoration of African Americans' presence in the United States. From the arrival of the first slaves in 1619 in Jamestown, this is 2019. So 400 years of African American presence is being commemorated or celebrated.
And it's so important for people to realize 400 years, because when you talk about what's illegal, you know, what's illegal and discriminating against African Americans, that's only been since 1964. So it's an easy year for me to remember. So,
right.
So, you know, 54, 55 years of being legally equal in society compared to a 400-year presence.
Right. Well, the things kind of took a back seat after the Civil War. Reconstruction was not a positive and not a fruitful thing, because, as you know, with backdoor dealings in Congress, the feds were the Southerners had a deal with the Union to take the federal troops out of the South. So consequently, the Klan, Jim Crow, peonage, all that existed up until mid-century.
Exactly. So there's an event taking place, because Juneteenth is the 19th, which is next, Wednesday?
Yes.
So what event are you participating in that commemorates that?
Well, the title is called Let's Talk, and International Day of Drumming. So this particular event centers around a lot of landmarks, the 40-year anniversary of our existence in the United States, and also International Drumming Day takes place that day. and also Juneteenth. So we're just putting all that together in this one big kind of presentation with my organization, the Traditional Music Society, and the Soke Dance Company. And we're going to actually present to them the understanding of how the drum is so central to African people and African-American people as well.
Right. Which, you know, this is a good time since you've got not one, but two African drums sitting right in front of you.
Right.
To ask if you could just give us just, you know, a little bit of African drumming to let us know what that sounds like.
Right. And I think the whole idea of the presentation is to let people know how drums communicate, how they talk. And so you're talking about art form that goes back 7,000 years in recorded history of different rhythms and orchestrations that people can recognize in the village as during their daily lives. So these things have been recorded by drummers. And for example, particular major events are being celebrated. For example, this particular rhythm is called Lamban, and it celebrates the history of the trek of King Mansa Musa and his entire tribe across the Sahara Desert to Mecca for Hajj, and it's called Lamban.
And be warned, I may have to interrupt you, you know, as I was saying earlier, okay, not to be disrespectful to the ancestors, but, right, you know, to keep us on the air at the same time. So
I'll just play a few bars.
That'd be wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. That's Lamban. So that people can recognize that drumming rhythm in the village, and they say, oh, they're celebrating that particular historical event.
Ah, so every African village, do you think, had a different sort of sound, rhythm?
They all had different drumming and different language, because a lot of these drums are based on language.
Okay, that other drum then. So what does that one
that's
sound like?
That's called a lunga. Actually, its common name is called talking drum. So this particular drumming actually, it's a variable pitch drum, meaning that it has different pitches depending on how you squeeze it and strike it. And so if the way I hold it, if I don't squeeze it very much, I get a low sound. I squeeze it a little more, a little more, a little more, and the pitch goes up. This is from the Dagbama people of northern Ghana, and I give an example of something in our culture that we can recognize to show you how it actually creates a melody. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They've taken their language and actually duplicated. This particular drum is constructed so it can duplicate their language so they can actually hear the language through the rhythm.
I love this. I love this. I love the radio experience we're creating.
Exactly.
You know, which you know leads to my question of why do you think African drumming is a good way of connecting the past to the current?
I think it's a great prototype or an example of how we should communicate as people in the world. You know, because like the subtitle is "The Drums Talk, So Why Shouldn't We?"
What do you think the drums, what is it about a drum versus a saxophone or versus a guitar or a piano?
Well, it's the first drum. It's the first instrument. Besides the voice, it's the oldest instrument. And it's primordial, you know. And I don't want to say primitive, but primitive in the sense that it is the first. And a lot of what we hear in terms of a melody and harmony in those particular elements of music, you got to understand that the rhythm is the most important out of all of those elements in music.
I'm in the middle of reading a book about creativity by Questlove. Mm-hmm. So I'm learning a little bit more about drumming than I've ever known before. And this is also helping with that. Could you tell us a little bit, just real quick, where your event's going to be next week?
It's going to be at Unity Temple on the Plaza. And and it's going to start at 6:30 until 8:30. And you can go on their website, Unity Temple on the Plaza, or our website, traditionalmusicsociety.org, and get more information in terms of the time and the fee, et cetera, et cetera.
Bird Flemings, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Our time is up, and it's a shame because I could talk to you probably for another hour and hear more drumming.
Yes.
Earlier, we talked about urban heat islands and how Kansas City tries to keep everyone cool, and we've revisited our conversation with AY. You can find all those conversations on our website a little later this afternoon, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll go to Hill. I mean, kind of, sort of. A local artist has a new exhibit all about the underworld, and we'll talk to him about it. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, Salisa Kalakal, and intern Riley Keister. Kester. I'm sorry, Riley. I mispronounced your last name. Sorry, girl. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. In for Gina Kaufman. Up to date is up next.